Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Well, summertime and the living is easy. Beautiful day as I record this, and if you believe some of the tabloid papers in the UK, we're in for a heat wave. I will believe it when I see it, but right now I'm feeling it. I've got to get a move on here because there isn't a lot of time. Got a lot to talk about. We're having Linda Moulton Howe as guest this time. We're going to be talking about a most amazing hybrid case, which I first talked about on radio in 2005. And we're also going to talk about the disappearance of Flight MH370 and whatever else occurs to us as we talk. So Linda Moulton Howe from Albuquerque, New Mexico, coming right up. Thank you very much to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for designing the website www.theunexplained.tv and maintaining it, getting the show out to you. That's the way to contact me. You can use the links on the website if you want to send me an email, suggest guests, anything like that. We'll be doing some shout-outs very soon, not on this edition, though we've got to press on. If you want to make me a donation to the show, that is also the place to do it. www.theunexplained.tv. We are the independent media, and we need your support because we are going to do it. Right, let's get to Linda Moulton Howe, a return visit to her. Linda, thank you very much for coming back on The Unexplained.
Well, it's great to be back here with you, Howard.
The lovely thing about you, Linda Moulton Howe, is I know that when I dial that number, the phone will ring two or three times. You'll pick up the phone and bright as a button, you will be there. You know, not everybody's that good.
Well, I think that you and I and a lot of people in the media, we function with this built-in clock. And when we have something to do, it's almost like we are a magnet attracted to the phone, knowing we have to be there. So thank you.
Well, you know what they say, when you've absolutely positively got to be there. Or was that Federal Express? I'm not sure. Okay. I want to start, if I may, with the mysterious case of Flight MH370, because it has is something that has piqued my interest very much, and I know it's piqued your interest as well. How is it that it's nearly 2 months now, a plane can take off loaded with passengers, seemingly veer from its course if it did, and then completely vanish, having turned off most of its communication systems? I say most for a reason. I'll explain to you in a moment. But what do you make of this case, Linda?
Well, it has been such a strange ride, as you know, and I have been working off and on with a retired Navy captain who, for 23 years, he spent his life doing all kinds of navigation, very familiar with the beeps and all of that. And he originally came up with, I thought, a very good analysis of the Inmarsat so-called pings, and came down to a part of the ocean west of Perth where he thought that there was an overlap from where they had the geography of the pings, and that the overlap would be where they would find the plane. Well, time went forward from there, and in fact, the investigators did essentially what Mark Wood, the retired Navy captain, had suggested to me, and we had done a report. But according to the investigators, they found zero. And throughout all of this, I have gone to Mark saying, what do you think? And he said, right now, this whole issue of Inmarsat and those pings, and that whole swing of the investigation going on what is called the southern arc of where the plane might have gone, was basically hanging on those pings. And now today, in June of 2014, the pings themselves have been disparaged. There has been new information basically questioning Inmarsat. We've seen on CNN and Fox here that Inmarsat has actually had to have people come on television to defend their work. And so when you have as many people who have been experts in aviation, navigation, satellites, underwater, Navy, and so forth, and that they do not even agree with each other at this point, what does that leave? And then back in May, I posted an Earth Files headline, "Is this why NSA has classified all information about MH370? And this was coming through your UK mail online. And the headline was, quote, 11 terrorists with links to Al-Qaeda have been arrested on suspicion of being involved in the disappearance of MH370. Suspects were arrested in the capital, Kuala Lumpur, and the state of Kedah, said to be members of violent new terror group, said to be planning such attacks. Interrogations came after demands from agencies including the FBI and MI6 in London. Manifest revealed presence of consignment, and this had to do with shipments that were going on this plane, MH370, that this mail article was linking to this new brand of terrorists. The airline has admitted 200 kilograms of lithium batteries were among the items in its compartment, and the airline has refused to say what other baggage it was carrying, quote unquote, for legal reasons related to ongoing probe. Now, I took the time to detail what was in your respectable mail online, was picked up by all kinds of media here in the United States. And yet, Howard, all of those details must have disappeared from the media within 24 or 36 hours. With all of these questions, this suddenly emerges, and this was in May, a month ago, and it is raising all kinds of issues about what the FBI and MI6 and other intel agencies might know about some new terrorist group. And yet, it disappears. Now, in England, did you see any follow-ups after that May 5th to 6th time period in any of your media about this alleged group, the missing or strange discrepancy in the weight, the questions about what was on the plane manifest in terms of what they had in the cargo? Did you hear and learn anything more?
Linda, look, I'm an avid looker at the Mail's website, and I read the paper every day. I mean, professionally, I have to. We get all the papers where I go these days. Yes, I'm aware of the story, but I'm also aware of the propensity of even the British media, which is pretty reliable, to something that it thinks is a story and then suddenly forget all about it. So there is a plausible and possibly understandable explanation for this, but my gut tells me, as I'm sure your gut tells you, there are too many of these questions, and those questions have remained unanswered. And I don't think it's a conspiracy involving the media. I just think they felt they were onto something, and those particular lines of inquiry were closed down simply through the lack of information. This is not unique. We saw similar things in 9/11, where there were strands and reports and things that were said early on, and then they were just mysteriously and very quickly forgotten about. So I'm not sure what this is, but I think it's worthy of further investigation. What I do know is that, as you said, a lot of experts have been completely baffled. Look, about a week after this disappearance happened, I spoke to a leading aviation expert, somebody who'd investigated crashes, based at Loughborough University, which is a big centre of excellence for engineering in the UK. And his belief, very sincerely, was that we would quite soon find wreckage, and there was probably a logical explanation in the way of mechanical failure, something like that, to do with the loss of this plane. Well, count the weeks since then, and still nothing. For a whole mess of reasons, it doesn't add up, does it?
No, and we do have the history in the past of the Michigan flight where there was a jet that took off in, I think it was 1952, and there were witnesses on radar to the Kinross jet where they saw this big, large object coming toward the jet. that had taken off from Kinross to investigate the report of this, whatever this thing was up in the sky. And there was radar confirmation that the jet was absorbed, I believe was the word originally used, and it was 1953. I just was correcting myself here. And the very fact that that occurred in 1953, it was written about in Major Kehoe's book, Flying Saucers, Top Secret, and I have seen a script that somebody was putting together about that amazing Kinross case that you don't hear much about, and yet it was the first and publicized of a F-89 encounter. It was the date was November 23rd, 1953, and the very fact that there was radar confirmation that the F-89 was absorbed or went into or was captured by this large glowing object over the Great Lakes is something that I think that we have to keep in mind. And then, in addition to the F-89 being absorbed or taken up with two men in it, by the way, and both of those men, nothing was ever found. No remnants of the plane, the men, they literally disappeared from the earth in November of 1953. And then there was the famous case in Australia, and that is the Valentik case. And that took place a few years later, and that is when there was Valentik had taken off from southern Australia area, I think Brisbane, and he was reporting the size of this object that was up in front of him, and that it was a very large silver round object. All of that was with lights. Pulsing lights, and the control tower was in communication with him, and they were recording this discussion. And a lot of people don't know this part, Howard. I talked with J. Allen Hynek, the astronomer and founder of the Center for UFO Studies, before he died in 1986 spring, and I had talked with him about this very issue only a couple of years before at a conference, and he told me directly that he was allowed to listen to the whole control tower tape out of, I think it was Brisbane, and that after those last words having to do with that the object seemed to be coming toward Valentik, and he sounded concerned, that Alan compared this. He said, the next sound on the tape sounded to me like metal cans rolling around in an empty oil drum. That was a direct quote. Mm. And he disappeared. So now we have, on the record, radar, two cases where a pilot in a plane, or two in Michigan, have literally disappeared with people in communication, and no part of the craft or the person has been discovered. So what would be the signatures in the absence of no evidence? And here we have the absence of evidence in MH370, and so the mind does leap to these historic cases where planes and pilots have disappeared in the presence of lights, but we don't even have testimony to a light or anything like that, because the only recorded sound from the cockpit, we've all heard what's been released, sounds totally mundane.
Right. And for those who think that the cases that you outlined couldn't possibly equate in any way, on any level, to the case of MH370, and all of this is outlandish, bear this in mind, and this is one of those things that appeared around the time this was first reported, when we were first getting to know about this. I was listening to the London radio station LBC, which is a talk station here. I used to work there a long time ago. And one of the first callers was a woman, and she said she'd been a pilot. And she reminded us, not that I knew in the first place, but reminded listeners, she was kind enough to do that, that the engines on this plane reported automatically back to their base so that their status, any problems with them, could be instantly seen by teams back where the engines were made. And I think that may have gone for other systems on the plane, irrespective of whether the beacons were shut down, whether a voice communication was shut down, they would continue reporting. What I want to know is, why did those reports about those things more or less go away? If that's the fact, if those systems analytically were reporting back somewhere, someone knows what they were saying.
Yeah, and don't you have the sense that the strange up and down reporting on MH370, for those of us who have been in the media for a long time, have had the underbelly of repressed information, the sense of counterintelligence controlling what was leaked out or who was allowed to talk. It has had that feeling right from the beginning that we were never, ever getting everything that everybody knew. And part of the problem is that Malaysia, which is definitely a different country with different ways of doing things, had control of the information until a place like Inmarsat leaked those beeps. And then you had the feeling that there were people who were upset that information that might be true was coming out. So why would the Malaysia government, perhaps in conjunction with somebody else in Intel somewhere, NSA even, the NSA in the United States, based on the leaks by Snowden, would suggest that they would know almost anything and everything that was going on in the air?
That is what I find probably the most, well, not probably, definitely, the most incongruous thing about this. Are they really telling us that something of that size isn't tracked to its ultimate conclusion, whatever that conclusion may be, by something somewhere? And the further away we get from this, remember the race to find the black box flight recorder and the beacon that indicates where it is? Well, we were told that that would be active for about 3 weeks or a month. Well, we've passed that now, so presumably, am I right in saying that that thing has stopped sending? I just don't understand where we are with this. And there are too many red herrings. Cases like a couple of weeks ago, a British woman, I think she was, reported flying over the area, looking down in an area approximating to where people thought the plane might have disappeared. That was off Perth somewhere, and seeing something that might have been wreckage. There are too many questions in this bizarre case. There are too many things that don't add up. Not questions, things that do not add up. And I just feel that probably we're never going to get the truth now about this.
And Howard, why is the National Security Agency in the United States classifying MH370? This goes back to on March 24th, 17 days after 370, the transponder was turned off. There was this attorney in California who filed a Freedom of Information Act request to the National Security Agency, and this is the way it reads in the actual document that she filed, quote, request for any and all documents in possession of NSA relating to missing flight, Malaysian flight MH370, which disappeared on March 8th, 2014, with three American citizens on board, close quote. That's the tie to the NSA, the three American citizens. And on April 24th, this attorney in California issued a press release along with the formal reply that she got from the NSA on NSA stationery, National Security Agency and Central Security Service, Fort George Meade, Maryland. And it says in this letter, quote, we have determined that the fact of the existence or non-existence of the MH370 materials you request is a currently and properly classified matter in accordance with Executive Order 13526 and so forth. Huh. Now, I and a bunch of other people that I know, including the retired Navy captain, why would the NSA not just simply say, they could have written back a letter that said, we are not investigators on this case, or we do not know the answers, or this is a classifying of any and all material they have related to the disappearance of MH370. It was very specific, legal. So it's as if the NSA has replied to a FOIA request implying that they have information about the disappearance of MH370 and it's classified.
Isn't that bizarre? Because what you would expect,
this answer.
Yeah, what you would expect, Linda, is from a government like ours, they would typically say, security services here, they would typically say, and I suspect in the United States, they might typically say, this is not within our jurisdiction. However, we are continuing to monitor developments and assist wherever necessary, not classify everything.
I know. So it makes all of us more suspicious. It makes it sound, you combine the NSA classified with that UK Mail online story about the 11 terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda who have been arrested on suspicion of being involved in the disappearance of MH370, a story that is there for a 24-hour cycle and then suddenly disappears with no comment or anything else. And part of a question that I have for you is the very fact that your UK government really came down, I thought, overly hard against The Guardian, insisting that they destroy their hard drives that had the Snowden documents after The Guardian had gotten all the information out to the New York Times and ProPublica and so forth. Would that action by the UK government against The Guardian, which I think is one of the best media outlets in the planet, is The Guardian, would it indicate that when this story surfaced, having to do with a whole other terrorist facet in MH370, that MI5 or MI6 could have moved against the Mail or somebody else in some indirect way, and that's why all news following that headline seemed to have disappeared?
Well, I find this odd. The erasure of the hard drive, or the source of data, is a most bizarre thing, because we all know that in this day and age, sources of data like hard drives or flash drives, whatever you want to use, are easy to copy. So are we genuinely saying that nobody there has still got some of this information? I think somebody somewhere might, even it's through a back-channel source, perhaps. I find it hard to believe that everything might have been erased, but then what do I know? And the other caveat...
The Vanity Fair here did a brilliant, one of the longest articles they have ever done on Snowden and what happened between Greenwald and The Guardian and so forth. And it goes into great detail with the editor of The Guardian explaining how the doors were closing down on The Guardian from the UK government that was increasingly insisting that the government was going to move against The Guardian and perhaps close the newspaper down if they did not give them either the hard drives or destroy them, and goes into the issue that, of course, The Guardian got all the information that they had out to ProPublica and other, the New York Times and Glenn Greenwald, who was working for The Guardian and is now in Brazil, and ProPublica, and the outlets that have been able to, and I think there's been a writer at the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. So now, if The Guardian was getting out the information to these other outlets, and then finally the editor gives in to the increasingly aggressive UK government, and that said in the Vanity Fair article, that this is the Vanity Fair from May to June, that the government insisted that the hard drives be destroyed and that the editor of your Guardian has a piece of the destroyed hard drive and keeps it. So they physically destroyed the hard drives. Mm. I can't imagine what that is about, except the UK government is trying to put itself in the role that it has the right to be both physically aggressive legally, but physically aggressive to destroying actual hard drives. They made a point that way.
Well, the point that was made to us by the government here and the government there about Snowden and all of this information was that some of it, it being very highly irresponsible to release it or make it public in any way, some of it related very seriously to national security and could put lives at risk. But I don't believe that any responsible journalist would actually allow out information of that sort. I don't think that that would happen. So I think, yes, it's all very bizarre. Before we leave MH370, I just want to say that by the time this is heard, you know what it's like. There may be some breakthrough in the case. Something may happen. In which case, what we've been doing is speculating here, but intelligently speculating about it. And at the very least, if this turns out to have a rational and logical conclusion, and sadly, perhaps some kind of mechanical failure took the plane down, whatever, okay, and that's terribly sad, and it's appalling for the people whose lives will forever be scarred by that, the relatives, the loved ones, and what have you. However, it does not exonerate those who played a merry dance with information on this one and left us all running round in circles. Why was that?
Well, that is the question that all the relatives of these missing people have been asking since March 9th. And I feel the horrible sense that if you lost your mom, your dad, your wife, your husband, your brother, your children, and it's just completely disappearance with no answers. I understand the agony those people are feeling then and now. And if, Howard, if it is that, we'll call it the great mystery of the huge UFO complex phenomena, and that there has been something happened to this plane and all those people, like happened at Kinross and off the coast of Australia, and it is in another dimension, will any of these ever return? And if things are taken into another dimension, why? To what end? And this comes to a subject that I have been reporting about probably the most deeply of my professional career as an investigative reporter and TV producer, who has been trying to get to the bottom of what does our government, your government, and others know about other intelligences in this universe interacting with this planet. And whether MH370 falls into this category or not, it is clear that there are advanced technologies that can make any object, matter, disappear, either visibly because it can deflect photons and the object is still there, or literally is moving matter from what we'll call the XYZ axis of the everyday Earth that we're living in, can move it into, we'll call it dimension Q, and that when you take all the decades since World War II, when your government and our government and the Allies realized that they had objects that appeared to be metal or glowing lights that could literally move in rings around a flying jet in the air at such a speed that no human could ever have survived what the pilots were seeing and reporting, you know that we have had governments trying to hide from the world the fact that they had increasingly hard scientific evidence that they were dealing with both technology and the ability to interact with the laws of physics in ways that our human physicists had no understanding. And there is the foundation of what happened in World War II up to 2014, and what the NSA, CIA, MI6, all of them.
Hello? Now, Linda, you may have heard a bit of a silence there. I've removed some of it from this recording. But as you started to list the alphabet agencies
right.
and what they may or may not know about technologies of exotic kinds, I've never had that happen before. It was as if somebody flipped a button and you disappeared.
Yeah.
Now, I know Art Bell used to have this kind of thing all the time, but it just doesn't happen to me.
That's right, and it happens to me a lot. It is, from my point of view, it is mean-spirited aggression. Especially is it mean-spirited aggression now, given the fact that I was born and raised in the United States of America when the Constitution and the Bill of Rights seemed to have a really viable meaning to all of us. And in the Bill of Rights in the United States, it says that there would be free an open press. We are to be protected. There, in fact, the concept is in the United States and has been for at least a century that the media plays a fourth estate role with the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the congressional, that the media is the strong player that is a reality check on those three. And without the media always trying to find out the truth and the facts, so much corruption and so much mishandling of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights would have happened before 9/11. The media has played a viable role in what was once upon a time a really, I started to say, fresh. And I was thinking the word fresh, a fresh democracy, meaning that it really counted, that there had been democracies at various times in so-called historic experiments, but they never, ever were what the United States was before 9/11. Or let's put it this way, before the Kennedy assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And today, it's this feeling that if the Snowden revelations had not poured out when they did, that our country has, for all intents and purposes, been transformed by the NSA, CIA, DIA, NRO, and the whole long list into a fascist police state. And Jim Mars, who has written The Rise of the Fourth Reich in the United States, who wrote Crossfire about the Kennedy assassination being done by the U.S. government because Kennedy wanted to tell everybody, we're not alone in the universe. We have craft, we have bodies, and that there are other intelligences interacting with this planet. Bob Wood, who worked at McDonnell Douglas, Bob Wood and I have talked endlessly about the documents that have surfaced and been leaked, that is exactly why Kennedy was assassinated. And so there's a long list of people who have studied what has happened in the United States since that assassination, and they keep coming back to it's all linked to the same subject of where we left off just before somebody disconnected me from you.
Well, something happened, and I don't, when I'm using the phone, yes, when I'm using digital methods, you know, the more modern methods of communication, sometimes they screw up and you have to reconnect. But it just doesn't happen with the telephone, because in the US and the UK, we have pretty good telephone systems. But what intrigues me about that is, you know, what we are doing is speculating with a certain amount of evidence that you can view one way or you can view another. There will be people listening to this who think that we're both talking complete and utter drivel, and they are very much entitled to their view. I'm not sure about all of it. But what I am sure about is that it needs to be talked about. And I can't see what on earth, whether you're in the US, the UK, whether you're in Liverpool, whether you're in Arkansas, wherever you are, what the harm would be in discussing these things.
Well,
because, you know, it's a free country. It's supposed to be a free country.
Yes, exactly. And I'm not speaking from speculation. I am speaking from hard whistleblower leaks. To me, over the last 35 years, since I started trying to get to the bottom of animal mutilations and having law enforcement tell me eye to eye, Linda, the perpetrators are creatures from outer space. And then all of the paths that I have walked, the people that have talked to me from government agencies off the record, we are dealing with extraterrestrial biological entities from other places in the cosmos. They have physics that is far advanced to what we have had on this planet. They can neutralize or manipulate gravity. They can manipulate photons. That means they can be invisible. They can move from one point to another, like a sudden inertial leap, as opposed to us having to use Euclidean geometry and move point to point slowly compared, and that they can project three-dimensional holograms that the human mind and retina cannot discern from the world around us. And that means that we are dealing with advanced intelligences and advanced technologies that can monitor and interact with this planet without surface creatures knowing, unless they want us to know. And what would be the agenda behind this? That is what I and a lot of people have tried to understand. And how many types? Why is there this confusing menagerie? Well, for the first time, it's beginning to come into focus for me. One, why the UK government and the United States government have been so worried about any of this getting out, why your Prime Minister Churchill would have talked with Dwight Eisenhower as a general during World War II and said, we are dealing with celestial, was one of the words they used, celestial visitors, and we must keep this a secret for 50 years. That would have been from 43 or 44 into the 90s. So that religions don't collapse, governments don't collapse, stock markets don't collapse, because then during World War II, they thought this would be too much of a blow to the psyche of the world. Well, today, in 2014, I think everything has reversed. I think the vast majority of people around the entire planet are completely open to, even through their own histories and experiences, to the fact that we're not alone in the universe and something else is interacting here.
And it's not you saying that, Linda. We have to say it's not you, Linda Moulton Howe, standing there and saying that. Opinion polls, I think there was one this year, say that people are more receptive than ever. Of course, in Churchill's time, we had the anniversary of D-Day just a week ago, and we remembered the jackboot of Nazism that Europe was under and the great threat we faced and how that had to be neutralized. Of course, if that information got out then it would have been a game changer, and that may not have been a good thing at all. So I can understand that. But in this day and age, when we've seen Star Trek, we've had Star Wars, we've explored the cosmos, we know that sometimes things are withheld from us. Perhaps we're ready for this information.
Yes, and let me bring this down now to a tighter focus on the subject of hybrids and a humanization program on this Earth with our government and probably your government's cooperation, as astonishing as that might seem.
Well, a while ago, Linda, I did an interview, and I can't sadly remember the name of the person, a woman I interviewed when this was a national radio show on AM radio in the UK. I used to have a Saturday night late slot, and that's how The Unexplained began. And there was a book about a female hybrid who was most unusual, who was raised as a regular child, but certainly was anything but regular. I don't know if you remember that case, but it was
Rachel's Eyes.
Rachel's Eyes.
And the author are, there are two.
Two of them, yeah.
Helen Luttrell and Jean Bilodeau.
Right.
And what I was just going to go into was that case, because I was recently approached about going back into that book and the whole hybrid humanization program having to do with a whole other case that had me get the book, talk with Helen Luttrell and Jean. And so right now at earthfiles.com, I have done on Dreamland, on Coast, and at Earthfiles, three in-depth reports. On May 31st, the extraordinary case of an alleged ET human hybrid and U.S. government humanization program. There are two parts. All of the interviews that I've done are in MP3s in those Earth Files reports, along with an illustration that Helen Luttrell did for me in color for the first time. She said she'd never done it before. She did this for Earth Files to get across these extraordinary avocado green eyes with vertical black slits that I'm going to talk to you about here in a minute. And then after I had done these programs and these interviews with Helen and Jean, authors of Rachel's eyes, Rachel being the hybrid, I started receiving the most extraordinary letters from people not only in the United States but from around the world with their own encounters with people looking somewhat human but ending up having eyes like the Rachel character in the book that you've just talked about and I've gone into.
Well, listen, I didn't know, Linda, I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but I've often thought about that interview, and I certainly spoke to Helen, but I think I spoke to the two authors of this book.
Right.
And I remember sitting there on the radio, and I used to turn the lights down in the studio, and you could see the River Thames and the London Eye in the background, and I listened with utter rapt attention because, let me tell you, I went into that interview thinking this is going to be the most outrageous show that we've done. People are not going to buy this, and I really wondered whether we should have been doing it. And I have to tell you that that hour, hour and a half, whatever it was, passed with me being, apart from commercial breaks and news and all the rest of the stuff that you have to do when you're doing mainstream radio, I was utterly rapt, and I got such email traffic about that show. And, you know, I've lost that show, sadly. I don't have a copy. Wish I did. I really do.
The hybrid issue is probably the major reason for why non-humans are interacting with this planet. And I've known Jean Bilodeau, who is the co-author, for 25, or at least maybe 30 years of all of our joint work that we have done on animal mutilations. Jean is a grounded, smart, intelligent writer in Oregon. She helped Helen Luttrell do the book as a writer, but Helen is the mother of a girl who, this is not her real name, lots of real names are disguised still in this project, but Helen Luttrell is the real name, Jean Bilodeau is the real name, and Helen's daughter, who is called Marissa, she had childhood diabetes, became blind in her teen years, wanted more than anything else to go to college, and Helen, as a mother, tried to encourage and help her daughter fulfill this goal as somebody who was blind. And Marissa arranged with a college. It is a real college, the American River College, and it is in Sacramento, California. And at Earth Files, I have a letterhead from American River College with the permission of Jean and Helen. It's the first time the whole name and everything about it has been posted. It is at Earth Files. You can read a letter confirming that Rachel Nadine, but in the actual college letter, the real first letter, they asked me to black out because they keep using the word and the name Nadine, which is not correct. Mm. But that this Rachel, and we'll use the word Nadine, was a student in the spring of 1972 at American River College. This is where Marissa was attending college, got an apartment 2 days after Marissa had moved in, blind, being able to see a few things close up off and on. Her sight would go in and out. A colonel saying that he was from Mather Air Force Base in Sacramento had been recommended by the college to bring his daughter, Rachel, to talk with Marissa about them becoming roommates, knowing that Marissa could not see and that the colonel was saying that his daughter was somebody who had special needs in terms of food and needing a lot of alone time, and that they would make perfect roommates.
Right. I'm starting to remember this. And the claimed hybrid girl had all sorts of issues and difficulties connecting with our world and our life. You know, her life was by no means normal.
That's right. But when the colonel, who said this was his daughter, talked with Marissa, it was just that she had special food needs and her food would have to be delivered to the apartment and that she needed alone time. And Marissa had her mom come over. This is Helen Luttrell. And this is this amazing scene. It's described in detail by Helen at earthfiles.com at my website. You can hear it for yourself. How she meets Rachel for the first time at the apartment where Rachel is hurrying. She could definitely hurry and did not seem to want to stop to talk with Helen, which probably was shyness and her always being sort of afraid of humans. But Helen was able to describe her in great detail because Rachel hurried past and then came back with her arms. She had some books in her arms, and she apparently tripped over a rug. She was not, she would be described clumsy on a general basis. She didn't move very well around things. And she tripped on the rug, and Helen Luttrell, the mother of Marissa, caught her by grabbing a hold of her wrist. And as she did so, the black sunglasses that Rachel always had on slipped down, and Helen, eye to eye, only inches away, was staring at solid, think of the color of avocado near the pit. It is a light green. We're not talking about the dark green skin of an avocado. We're talking about the green inside of an avocado. And that the solid avocado green eyes that slanted upward, maybe about 15 degrees, had very clear, defined, vertical black pupils. And the first thing that went into Helen Luttrell's mind as she is staring at those eyes was a cat. And in the interview, I said, there are vertical pupils in cats, and there are vertical pupils in the reptile world. And she said, you know, Linda, that's true. I think I am so afraid of reptiles that I don't want to go there. So I've always told myself that I was looking at cat eyes, but the eyes that Helen drew for Earth Files that I'm looking at right now at my own news website, they are not the pupils of a cat. They are actually much closer to the reptile. And in my Earth Files report, I show a cluster of reptile eyes and a cluster of cat eyes. The drawing of Rachel's eyes are really truly more reptilian. But now let's go to something else fascinating. Helen realized that the wrist of this very thin, thin girl was not, there was no bone. And it startled her more than the eyes that she has grabbed on to. If you grabbed onto my wrist or I grabbed onto your wrist, any human is going to feel bone. The wrist bone actually projects in the normal human wrist. And what Helen was feeling was spongy. She compared it to something like if you grabbed a hold of a spongy tennis ball or a ball. That's what she was grabbing onto. And I asked her in the interview, on planet Earth, the only life form that I can think of that does not have some sort of an interior skeleton or something that would be spongy, it might be something in marine life or the exoskeleton of insects. And the insect has been described in all of this a lot when it comes to non-humans, but it's all jumbled up and quite confusing. So now I want to say we're dealing with hybrid U.S. Air Force conscious government. The colonel ends up after this incident because the Rachel goes to the father, the Air Force colonel, who's not her father, but called himself father, and tells him what has happened. And he gets in touch with Helen Luttrell and Marissa and says he wants to come over and explain. And here this man, who has documents and records that were confirmed by Helen Luttrell, who worked at McClellan Air Force Base at the time. They're both in Sacramento, McClellan and Mather. And Helen Luttrell worked doing secretarial work at McClellan, she had people in higher office and in the employment offices. She gave the name of Colonel. She uses Colonel Harry Nadine in the book. That's not correct, but she gave the real name and had a check done at Mather. And they had his name, his rank. They had papers on him at Mather that they shared at McClellan, which is very important to keep in mind here for a moment as we go forward. So Helen is confident that she is talking with a United States Air Force colonel with background and papers when he comes to talk about Rachel, and says that he worked at a place called Four Corners at Area 51 on the north side of Area 51 underground, and that he had been working underground since the 50s, and that he was the director or the head or the chairman or the manager of a humanization program for human-alien hybrids that our government was collaborating with extraterrestrial biological entities to see if hybrids could be made underground and then brought above ground to try to interface and learn how to work inside of the human civilization on the surface.
A humanization program. I remember it all now. Yep, I do.
Yes, and where all of this is dovetailing for me, Helen Luttrell says that Colonel Nadine talks specifically about a Project Garnet. Now, jump back in my life, my career, to April 9th, 1983. I had just signed a contract with Home Box Office in New York. I was starting to work on the script development for a program that HBO and I had agreed in the contract. It would be called UFOs, The ET Factor. HBO had come to me because of the work that I had done in the documentary for television called A Strange Harvest. This was my year work on trying to get to the bottom of animal mutilations, in which various excisions of bodies around the world from animals, every animal you can think of, had been being taken for decades that were bloodless, trackless, and that law enforcement and ranchers had themselves seen and had told me beams of light from glowing craft in the sky would come down into a pasture. I talked with people who had seen animals rise up in beams of light or be lowered down into pastures in beams of light, dead and mutilated. So the mutilation program is what took me directly into the extraterrestrial issue. From a hard science, environment, medicine background, I did my graduate work at Stanford. All of my original TV work was in medicine, science, and the environment. That's how I came to investigate the animal mutilations that took me right to ranchers and law enforcement, saying the perpetrators are creatures from outer space. In the project for Home Box Office, I had a meeting arranged for me by an attorney in New York, Peter Gersten, and an Air Force Office of Special Investigations agent named Richard Doty at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. I was there on April 9th, 1983. That is when he showed me now the famous alleged briefing paper for President of the United States on the subject of unidentified aerial craft and unidentified aerial vehicles. And in that paper, it said, extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapien. The Latin Homo sapien was in this paper. The next to last page, it started on projects, Project Garnet, Project Sign, Project Aquarius, Project Sigma. They were all listed and defined. And the top one was Project Garnet. All questions and mysteries about the evolution of Homo sapien on this planet have been answered and this project is closed. And I remember reading that over and over and over again, that the so-called missing link is extraterrestrial manipulation of DNA in already evolving primates. Extraterrestrials made humans. Now, I am interviewing Helen Littrell and Jean Bilodeau in 2014 May about their 2005 book, Rachel's Eyes. And Helen starts talking to me about specifically what she learned from Colonel Nadine, and Nadine talking about an extraterrestrial hybrid from Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, and uses that binary star system as the source, that this hybrid that they referred to as Chisky, C-H-I-S-K-Y, and that the colonel referenced that they were working underground, Four Corners, Area 51, on a hybrid program with this extraterrestrial human hybrid that originated from Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2 underground. And here is a description straight from Helen Littrell and the book and Colonel Nadine.
So after 21 years, all of these facts, these pieces of information, at last triangulate.
Yes. Oh, Wow. Yes, Howard.
Wow.
It is coming into focus in a way that is breathtaking to me.
But the question I asked Helen, I think it was, on air back then, it must have been 2005, so it's 9 years ago, what happened to Rachel?
Well, she disappeared, and I was going to come to that, the disappearance day of Rachel. Before we talk about the disappearance day of Rachel, let me just continue with, I've told you in 1983, I was reading this document at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, handed to me by an AFOSI agent that I had gone to working on a script for an HBO television. I was not there for any other reason. I was there to deal with events and UFOs and ETs for this HBO project, and I'm reading this document, and here is Project Garnet. Okay, jump to Rachel's Eyes, the book, and Helen Littrell and Jean Bilodeau, and here is straight paragraph, quote, Project Garnet controls all the information on genetic manipulation being carried out by aliens. ETs claim to have created the human race by hybridization using rhesus monkeys, and that the existence of Rh-negative blood is their proof. ETs are carrying out experiments creating hybrid human alien life forms using human ova and sperm, and that explains why all the human abductions over the years collecting eggs and sperm that they extract during abductions. They combine these extracts, then raise the fetuses in large tanks that look like aquariums. How many abductees have described that over the years, Howard, and no one has understood it. They use a solution of nutrients to sustain life until the hybrids are fully developed. This particular aspect of the humanization project is one of the conditions the government agreed to. They're talking about the United States government, agreed to under the terms of a treaty. It has been going on for many years. In fact, Helen understood it was since the late 1940s, right after World War II. One of or two hybrids, such as Chisky, are working right now in the underground labs at Four Corners, Area 51, with our human scientists right now. And then Chisky is quoted in the book directly from Colonel Nadine as saying this. Page 105, Rachel's Eyes. Many races of extraterrestrials have, over time, lost their reproductive abilities and now rely almost exclusively on the creation of new beings by cloning them from the existing population. The cloning programs always before emphasize superior intelligence at the expense of emotional and physical development. Only when it was too late to remedy? Did they notice that their physical strength and stamina were declining dramatically and that the population was becoming progressively more frail? Now, this goes on about the deterioration of the species, and I wanted to interject here two vital footnotes. In the RAF Bentwaters case in your country, where a Staff Sergeant James Peniston, Airman First Class John Burroughs, Airman Ed Kvancak, on December 26, 1980.
It's what we call Rendlesham Forest here, yeah.
That's right. And between 1 and 4 a.m., those three American Air Force men received permission from Central Security Control at RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge, shared base between the UK and the United States, to go out into Rendlesham Forest. Because why? Rendlesham Forest was totally private English land, civilian land, not part of the air bases. They get permission to go out. Why? Because there are all these multiple colored, one of the airmen said at the time that it reminded him of Christmas tree lights. And they go out into the forest, and what ensues for the next 3 days and three nights, December 26th, December 27th, and the sun is coming up on the 28th. And during those 3 days and three nights, a whole series of interactions between maybe 30 people on that military base and lights, but especially a craft, a black, glassy, not disc, a triangle, wedge-shaped, like a piece of pie. In the first night, in that 1 to 4 a.m., when a flash of light, brighter than anything, according to Peniston, and John Burroughs has lost all of his memory, Ed Kvancak is terrified to talk to anyone, Jim Peniston, only in the last two years, it was when I was working with Prometheus Productions in L.A. On Ancient Aliens, on a segment that took us to England, Jim Peniston, John Burroughs, and I and the crew. Before we left, we were in Phoenix, Arizona, doing interviews for Ancient Aliens and Prometheus Production. I am there, Peniston is there, and Burroughs is there. And it was only late in the afternoon, in the fall, approximately 2.5 years ago, that Peniston says, I want to show you the binary code I wrote down here. I brought my original logbook with me. John Burroughs, I could tell on the look on his face, he was shocked. Everybody was shocked. This was the first declaration by Jim Peniston of the binary code, including to John Burroughs, who was with him in the forest, who was there in the Air Force. Peniston never showed this to Burroughs until we were in TV production in Phoenix.
And the binary code was what was being used to communicate, the most basic way of communicating.
And the fast way to think about what happened is this. Peniston, this black glassy wedge shape seemed to materialize from the bright white flash of light that Peniston remembers. And Peniston, in a state of shock, takes out his logbook that he always used at all the plane crashes. Peniston, they depended upon him to go to plane crashes, write down details. He always sketched, and now he starts going into sort of automatic safety valve that people do. He pulls out his logbook. He starts going around. Now it's not an airplane. It's a black, glassy wedge in the forest that came out of the blast of light. But he starts walking around and sketching, and those sketches have been in Earth files and all kinds of reporting that I've done and so forth. And when he gets around to the front vertex point, he can see raised symbols. And these raised symbols come up more and more as we begin to understand that extraterrestrials have been making self-activating machines They don't need any biological entity in them because they are made to be self-activating on different planets. And this one was a self-activating machine that blasted out of white. And when Peniston dragged his hand over the glass at that point, over those raised symbols, that he could feel the temperature was even warm compared to the cold December night there in the forest. The whole thing was warmer. And those symbols, and when his fingers dragged over those symbols, into his mind came zeros and ones streaming rapidly. Now, what he never told anybody is that he, after this encounter in the forest, and they all end up back at their respective homes, Peniston could not get the zeros and ones out of his mind. It was driving him literally crazy. He was afraid to tell anybody. And this went on for, I think, a day or two. And it was beginning to affect. He couldn't sleep. He didn't want to eat. Everything in his life was going crazy because of these zeros and ones that wouldn't stop looping in his mind. And suddenly, like a telepathic voice, sit down and write this down. And he pulled out his logbook that he had done the sketches in, and he turns to the back of the logbook, about 10 pages from the back, and he starts doing zeros and ones. And when they kept going out of his head, and as he wrote them down, suddenly his mind calmed to peace. No more zeros and ones. And in the notebook, it literally trails off. It is fascinating because that was the end. That was the last. Well, Prometheus, executive producer Kim Sheeran, and I, Linda Howe, who was working with Peniston and Burroughs, we talked about how we needed to get people who could take those zeros and ones and try to figure out if there was code there. And I went to an astrophysicist who had built telescopes all of his life at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and another man who had done lots of code and binary analysis in the crop circles in England, who was based in Australia. Prometheus went to a computer geek, and those three people worked on the zeros and ones, and here was the first big problem, Howard. There was no indication of a decimal point. In the planetary Earth system, zeros and ones in binary code, when you come to breaking them into increments of 6, 7, 8 code analysis over the years, you need indications. And when it became clear that this zeros and ones look like latitude, longitude, you need decimal points in order to say a specific latitude and longitude, north, south, east, west, at some part in the northern, southern hemisphere of this planet.
So does this mean we don't understand this data?
Otherwise, yeah. And one day, the astrophysicist called me up and said, Linda, this is complicated and I need to show you. And we went to Google Earth, and the astrophysicist said, here are the different breaking in the code. And I'm going to give you all the permutations, and I did an entire Earth Files that takes you piece by piece through every permutation as you would move that decimal point. And it is many per interpretation of the zeros and ones. But they came to logical conclusions, the Australian scientist and the astrophysicist in the United States, that one of them is definitely, this is so interesting, the town hall center of Woodbridge, England. Now, that makes sense to me. It made sense to Burroughs and Peniston because the assumption we were operating is that this black, glassy triangle with the symbols on it was a self-activating machine that Peniston began also to tell us the truth about what he learned in what else came in the download, the zeros and ones. There was a telepathic communication, and here is what is germane to the hybrids, the hybridization program, so much that I have been exposed to in the animal mutilation program and abductions, that Peniston got the clear communication that the makers of the glassy self-activating machine were us, were humans or a form of humans or humanoids, 50,000 years in the future, time traveling back to the 20th and the 21st centuries to gather genetic material from Earth, where they had a close genetic relationship. Because why? Because something had happened to the DNA. It was no longer replicating. They were coming back to get genetic material.
To get some of ours, because they needed
as
it.
Band-aids in the future. This has come up in other variation themes, in abductions going back to the 70s and the 80s, and none of us had any context. Suddenly it's becoming very clear, Howard. We are in a survival program. The hybrid humanization program is a survival program related to extraterrestrials that are dying out if they don't do something to strengthen their stock. If they made us, if they made humans, if they made Homo erectus through the last 2 million years, and we're the latest model, we are a strong physical stock that's too violent, probably, but that the brain power behind whatever has happened in Neanderthal and Homo sapien has come from the extraterrestrial biological entities manipulating for their survival. And suddenly you begin to see this is almost like a symbiotic story, and how much of what has happened since World War II, of the appearance of non-humans. Why? Because the United States exploded atomic bombs. They exploded them first at White Sands in experimentation, and then they dropped them in Japan in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to allegedly end a war.
So to cut to the chase, Linda, and we're running out of time, and you and I always break time records with this, which is fine. But we're saying that the aliens got interested at around the time of Roswell because we were in danger of destroying ourselves, and thereby destroying their harvesting project. Right. Absolutely got it. What we've got to tie down is, because otherwise I'm going to worry about this, I can't remember what I was told in that 2005 interview about Rachel's disappearance. So just to tie this up and to park it for now till we talk again, what happened to Rachel?
It was not too long after the glasses slipped down. Colonel Nadine came and told Marissa that she disappeared. Every single scrap of everything she'd had in her bedroom was gone, but she left a gift. And Rachel left a note explaining her gift. And Marissa discovered the note and realized she could read it, and the gift was sight, that the extraterrestrial hybrid somehow had been able to engineer something in the blind Marissa, her eyes, and she could literally read the letter saying, "Goodbye, thank you, you've been kind to me, and I'm giving you a gift." And then Marissa realized, my God, I'm reading. And it was the gift of sight, and Marissa was able to read much better. Well, Rachel disappeared, and when Helen Luttrell went to the man at the McClellan Air Force Base to get in touch with Colonel Nadine to find out at Mather what is happening, where is Rachel, every shred of paper on Colonel Nadine had been pulled. Nothing was there that had been there. The colonel disappeared, Rachel disappeared, but they were left with all of the information that Colonel Nadine had shared with them, and Marissa was living proof and knew. Marissa was there, so Marissa and Helen knew that all this had happened. About 10 years later, Marissa, who had married, was at a cocktail party for Christmas and suddenly dropped dead on the floor amid a Christmas party.
Oh, Lord.
He was only 38 years old. Mm. And the issue has always been, was that natural or not? Helen is 82, soon to be 83 years old. She lives in Oregon. She wrote that book with Jean Bilodeau of The Writer. She wanted to tell the story. She is still there. She still is full of information conveyed to her by the colonel that disappeared. They did try very hard while they were writing the book. I've talked with Jean about it. They mm-hmm. did all of the normal investigations that you and I would do, trying to find somebody who they had a name, they had a military record. He's completely gone. But Helen said, he told me he was working underground at Four Corners, total classified area that you cannot get into, and she guesses that that's where he is.
And the smoking gun for you, Linda, we're going to have to park this here, but the smoking gun is, of course, that links back to 1983 and yes. Project Garnet. What an amazing story. And I've, as always, I've let you talk because there is no point in me making pointless interjections when you're telling such an interesting story. So I've let you do it. And thank you very much for giving me your time.
And
I must try.
Howard, this is like chapter one in the realization of how important hybrids are.
Well, then we've got to talk again, and we will. What I'd like to do, if anybody's hearing this and has a copy of that 2005 interview that I did, because it would be nice to hear that, I'd love to hear from you, because you know what, Linda? All these years on, since that show was on the radio in the almost the graveyard spot on Saturday night when they try out new programs, and I was there for a year and a half, I am finding people even now, and the show ended in 2006, who are telling me they have recordings and they never missed an edition. So we were doing something important then.
There's one other thing to let everybody know. All of this ties back to 1961, first abduction, Betty and Barney Hill. And Betty said that those grays that she was with had huge noses, vertical pupil eyes, and that particular type is named an arkaloid. The arkaloid is a specific type related to the Ebens. All of these pieces are coming together, even from 1961. The complexity of this, I hope your listeners will go to Earth Files. Those are completely available to everybody in the world right now. Look at the images, read the documents, and realize our government has known about these various types and the hybrid and humanization program since the end of World War II.
Linda, we've broken the unexplained record. My web guy is probably going to hang me out to dry for this, but we've gone and done it, and it's always you and me who do it. Don't go anywhere. Thank you very much to all of my listeners. Wherever you are, if you want to email me, go to www.theunexplained.tv. Same place if you'd like to make a donation to the show to help it to carry on. There I will have a link to Linda's earthfiles.com work. Thank you very much. More great guests in the pipeline. Thank you very much to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for getting the show out to you. I've got to go now. My name is Howard Hughes. I'm in London. Until next we meet, stay safe, stay calm, and please stay in touch. Take care. Bye-bye.